Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson. Hey, Fred. I was starting to write an article on risk management and failure mode and effects analysis. So I started to do a deep dive into this topic, and I wanted to chat with you about it.
Okay.
Which is, you know, we deal in risk, and we're reliability engineers, reliability managers. We deal in risk, and yet there's a lot of different definitions for risk, and there's a ton of standards on risk management.
The ISO group kind of rolled out, 5 to 10 years ago. They started converting a lot of their standards to risk-based decision-making, or risk, including the assessment of risk, and then didn't do a very good job of defining what they meant by that. I think some consultancy probably had a hand in doing that.
Yeah, and different fields look at risk from a different point of view, and so you get... You get fields like the medical device industry, and it has its ISO 14971, mm-hmm. which is a risk management standard. And then you have automotive has a set of standards that relate to risk. Mm-hmm. So depending on the field you're in, and there's others, examples, you can get different approaches. And I thought it'd be fun to kind of circle back from a reliability point of view, what is our view of risk, and what's the relationship between reliability and risk? And there's going to be a good relationship there.
Yeah, and I remember when all the ISO stuff was changing over, and ASQ has been involved in, you know, working with ISO standards and organizing teams and stuff like that for years. And so they, at some point, I think they asked the reliability division or somebody in the reliability division said, hey, let's just add risk to our name. So we're the reliability and risk division now. But I've never seen more than a mention of it in articles or content or webinars or anything. And I think part of it is exactly what you're saying, is there's so many different definitions of it. Now, the easiest definition I know of, and I've been looking at risk and risk management stuff for a while and expanding on it, on Ascendo.
I'm on the edge of my seat, by the way.
But the easiest, most universal definition of risk is uncertainty. It's just uncertainty. We're unsure of the ramifications of our next action or our next decision or of the current situation. It's just, and it could be good or it could be bad. And vast majority of people hear risk and think of only the downside risk. We're going to lose money. Warranty's going to go up, or this or that or the other thing. And they're like, no, it could also be you make too much money and don't spend your warranty accruals, and so your finance guys are unhappy with you. It's a better problem to have, but it's just as costly in the long run.
Okay, so let me push back on it for a minute. And I know what, in fact, I was looking at ISO 31000, mm-hmm. which defines risk as the effect of uncertainty mm-hmm. on objectives. So you're right on solid ground there from that ISO standard. So let me push back, because I've always wondered, can't you have risk even though you're certain?
Oh, sure. I'm thinking of when I was rock climbing, as I put my foot on a hold and like, I've got a hold, I know it's risky, and I don't have another option here.
Right.
And if the gods are with me, my foot will stay on that hold and I won't fall off. And I just watched the Free Solo two nights ago. This guy that climbs El Capitan without a rope.
I think I've seen that.
Yeah. At one point, it's funny, and it relates back to how we perceive risk or interpret risk or identify it in our day-to-day lives. Is they at one point in the documentary, they put him in an MRI or CAT scan or whatever it was, and they were showing him images that most people's amygdala would light up as a fear response.
Okay.
It was normal people would see a knife coming at you or a scene from a horror movie or, you know, stuff like that. And your brain would react with, you know, fight or flight kind of response. And his was dead flat. It just didn't respond. And part of it was, is that he's like this elite international top of the tier rock climber that also does free solo, which very, very few people do. And he's confident enough in his skills and his preparation. He runs the route with ropes, with crews, over and over and over again until he knows every move. And then he does it free solo. So it's not like he just goes out and goes, oh, I'm going to go climb this impossible mountain without a rope. No, he doesn't do that.
So he's reducing the uncertainty by his preparation and skills and practice and strengths.
Right.
That reduces the uncertainty of, which would be, of course, right. falling in that case.
But, you know, me just sitting at the bottom of El Capitan going, nope, I'm not climbing that. I'm in that get back in the car, nothing go home kind of thing. That. Yeah. There's nothing uncertain about it, but my perception of risk is different than his. And we come to it from completely different positions, right? I'm a amateur climber that I struggle in the gym on routes that are similar to that. Plus it's all granite and crack climbing, which I just really do not like doing because it hurts. But the idea is that in our business situation, you know, I'm walk up to the program manager saying, this set of components is running really hot, or it's doing this, or we've had multiple failures in the prototypes and stuff. This is a high risk for too many field failures, and we might have some analysis behind it, whatever. And it's not completely certain, right? We have some analysis, we have some conjecture, we have some evidence, and then the program manager looks at it and goes, and he's thinking to himself, I need to ship on time. I got all these other assets in motion. I got to coordinate. I did all this stuff. That's not that big of a problem. Let's just drive on. And so his perception of risk, even with the same set of information, is weighted and viewed in a different way. And he goes, well, that's not big enough a risk for me to take care of.
I'm thinking about that. So there's the perception of risk, and then there's the actuality. Let me jump in on a part of this to see what you think, because I want to hold that uncertainty mm-hmm. up on the wall for a minute, but then go into most of the standards talk about that you start with the concept of harm, and you don't want to have harm, like harm to property, harm to people, harm to environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, a scalpel will harm you. Yet the net benefit is a benefit. You know, if you take out your exploded appendix, you're going to harm the skin, but you're going to save the patient. So it's a balance. It always
is. I'm going to concede that.
Okay.
Right. Absolutely. Okay. So then most of the standards then go into the two elements, which is the how severe is the consequence of the harm mm-hmm. and what's the probability of that harm. And so you have this unwanted event where somebody gets hurt or there's some damage significant to property or to the environment. And then how severe is that would be one element. And then what's the likelihood that it's going to occur is another element.
Yep.
So you have these two elements that always seem to be present in the subject of risk. And so I wanted to reflect for a minute with you on how that relates to reliability.
The way I interpret that most of the time is that it's a hazard analysis, right? It's a slightly different focus than if you're in the medical division or medical device product or aerospace or whatever. And you usually see a graph that has, this is a high probability, high severity. We're going to make that bright red. We just can't ship the product if it's got that issue going on. And then it goes yellow, green, and other color codes and stuff. But it just reminds me of a hazard analysis, and it's okay. And you could also call it a type of FMEA where you'd look at the two columns first and plot it out that way. The issue that I find is that risk is a superset of reliability. That's the way I think of it. So a product failing is not the only risk. It could be that it's in the wrong market. It could be that it's just not the right solution. It could be a competitor comes out with a much more elegant and less costly solution, and then we don't have a product. Or it could be that somebody contaminates one of the tablets in a drugstore and poisons two people. And was that, I'm trying to think, it wasn't Excedrin, it was somebody else years ago, right?
Tylenol?
It was it was Tylenol. Now we have all these, you know, tamper-proof seals on everything.
Right.
Think of, you know, an act of terrorism or a prank that cost people some lives actually created a $1 billion industry.
So you're saying you have reliability, and that could be one aspect, but there's bigger aspects. You can have brand, you can have a whole, you know, marketing, whole set of things.
Oh yeah, yeah, and I think that ISO standard 31000, that series is about enterprise risk management, and it's similar to what Shell used to do and be famous for doing their scenario. Analysis, you know, there's scenario planning. Well, what if BP does this? Or what if this oil field comes in or doesn't come in? Or what if, you know, a big ship gets stuck in the Suez Canal? It's kind of, well, what do you do if this problem occurs? What do you do if somebody uses your product in an evil way? Or what if somebody, a major celebrity, says we need to boycott your product? Those don't really have much to do with reliability. But they certainly impact the uncertainties surrounding putting a product in the market. So enterprise risk management, it can be at the board level of a public traded company or the senior management level. Reliability should be considered there, but it's just one piece. And so reliability engineers are good at doing hazard analysis and assessing risks of unwanted failures or unsafe failures, things like that. We also have hand in how's a customer use a product and how do they misuse it? And is that going to cause a problem? But it's still only a subset, but we happen to use many of the tools that risk management frameworks call us to use, but we just don't do it with the scope that other standards call us to go to.
Okay, so that's a good framework. So risk is a larger subject, and then you have what reliability people, or I'll say RAM, you know, availability, mm-hmm. maintainability, what their objectives are,
yep.
is a subset of that. In other words, we can control certain things we can't control. I remember working on some car programs at GM that turned out to be really ugly cars, but they could be super duper reliable.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean they're going to sell well and be successful.
Oh, it was the police cruiser one that
Caprice,
yeah, that is an ugly car. I'm sorry,
that was a boat.
Yeah,
that's the last full frame vehicle that GM made. And
I hope you weren't working on that one. You weren't the industrial designer on that one, right?
I was not the designer, but I was in reliability on the Caprice. So I was kind of thinking of that one when I was saying it. And
gotcha.
So Jack worked really hard to make it reliable, but geez, could you improve the look of it?
Yeah.
So now, so staying within our wheelhouse, so to speak, then that goes into the more traditional part of risk management, that is the severity and probability of harm.
Yeah.
And that those are the things that we can impact and have some degree of control around.
You got to expand that, though. I think risk management in these frameworks, even for the reliability sphere that we work in, primarily in, say, a product mm-hmm. development team or asset management work, is many of these frameworks talk about that you need to have a systematic process to assess risk. You know, you don't just walk past that machine that's dripping oil all over the floor and just get so used to it you don't see it anymore. You need to create a way to identify those and add them into the matrix.
Completely. That's your hazard analysis, where you're listing out all the hazards and then you're performing a risk assessment
right
on those hazards, which includes the severity and the likelihood of harm or probability of harm.
Right. And you're assuming that it's part of it is doing a thorough assessment and identification of it. But that's easier said than done. I mean, there's so many times when you sit down with a team and do a risk assessment, and they just pull out the one from last time that the FDA approved and update it, and ignore the changes, the components, ignore change the vendors, you know, but not ignore consciously, just don't see it. And so I think the frameworks are saying you need to have a systematic process with feedback that you have a way to identify these things. And then that's input into the hazard analysis stage and prioritization. Okay, well,
I agree with you. Your systematic process that is surfacing issues, mm-hmm. Not assuming that it's the same as last year or something.
Right.
And that input, that data then goes into a given analysis that might be part of a product development program. And FMEA,
it's part of that.
The article that I'm in the process of writing is the relationship of FMEA to risk management. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say a couple things for listeners here. If you're looking at FMEA and risk management, be aware of a couple of things. One is the FMEA does not get you the probability of harm. And so your FMEA cannot directly calculate a risk assessment in the traditional sense, because the FMEA assumes that you have independent events. And when you have tandem events, then that goes into a different analysis. And so be very careful about you get the right relationship between FMEA and risk management, because the FMEA will not give you the probability of harm. You need to do a fault tree or probabilistic risk assessment. So I wanted to give that commercial in there to people to be aware of that.
I agree. I think fault tree is the way to go, but I would go to FMEA first as part of the risk identification. You know, what are the things that we know that we have uncertainty around that are unclear? Or this one has a probability of being serious, so let's kick this one into the... But we have three levels of protection, layers of protection on it. So that's back into a fault tree, you know, or some other similar method. But when I first looked at these frameworks, I was like, well, we do hazard analysis, we do FMEA, we do this, we do that, we do projections of rates of failures and harm, you know. And it took me a while to get my hands around is that, yep, we do, but it's only one piece of it. and so we have a great opportunity as reliability folks to help the rest of the organization with identification skills, with prioritization skills, with assessment skills, with calculating the harms and risks and so on, or the probabilities. Which brings up the next point. Then you got to actually do something about it. You got to mitigate the risks, you know. And
right.
One of the most popular articles on the Sendo website, and it gets somewhere in the order of 5,000 to 6,000 views a month, is 4 risk management strategies. And I got a comment on it the other day. Is that all there are, or are there other strategies? Huh. Like, I'm sure there's other ones. Those are the ones I thought of, you know, or I know about. And
what you're saying really is advocating for a reliability program or a reliability plan.
Oh, yeah.
In other words, we can't just throw out a hazard analysis here or an FMEA there. It needs to be part of a overall plan that looks at the entire risk of a program, mm-hmm. and then uses the right tools. We talk about gap analysis as the way to identify your tools and help supporting decisions. So this all comes back to the reliability plan as the way to organize the tasks that are needed to address the risk.
And then if your organization has a enterprise risk management system or plan in place, then the reliability plan or even a product development plan should have hooks in it that say, you know, if something shows up that this is a serious consequence, you know, and some risk that it can happen or probability it can happen, then there's a notification sequence, right? When we're doing FMEAs on a program, on a project, I should say, we're designing a new bicycle, for example, and we're working with them. If we come up with something saying, you know, under these loads, this support tube's going to fracture and throw the rider off, if they're going 40 miles an hour and hit a pothole or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that would be serious, especially if you're the one riding the bike. And so in the way I've always done FMEAs is I would talk to the program team, and then it would be prioritized among the risks within that team, right? But what a risk management framework says is, well, that one probably needs to get elevated to a higher authority within the organization to say, is that an acceptable risk to take, or do you really need more resources to solve that problem, kind of thing.
I'm completely tracking with you, and I agree with your comments. Just to summarize some of my own thoughts, is the severity level can be a trigger for further action, like moving over to hazard analysis if it's a safety, mm-hmm. depending on what your occurrence and detection are in the FMEA. And the end result of the FMEA, interestingly enough, is risk is reduced to an acceptable level.
Right.
And so there has to be some company guidance, management guidance, or other guidance as to what is acceptable level of risk.
Right. And so the last piece in my mind for a risk management structure in enterprise risk, or even if we're doing it within a program within the reliability group, is a feedback mechanism. And this is ISO standards do this all the time, right? And it makes perfect sense. Is what is your mechanism to review your process? Did you miss a risk that manifested itself and surprised you? How did you miss that? What part of your process was aware but didn't recognize it? You know, those kind of things. The feedback loop, as you know, the Plan, Do, Check Act starts and other similar mm-hmm. ones, DMAC and all those others, is that's built into a lot of these risk frameworks. Is, and it's a good practice in reliability planning. You know, Carl, we don't talk about that as much as we should. So what worked and didn't work in that last program, and how do You're we right. improve? We don't talk about that as no, much we as we should. That might be a subject for another top podcast.
It might be.
Yeah.
And if, as a listener, if you have some ideas of what your thoughts about risk and how risk relates to your job as a reliability engineer or reliability manager or whatever field you're in, let us know that, because this topic is going to be continuing, ongoing. And I think we all have a lot to learn about this, particularly how you integrate the different bodies of knowledge when you come together on risk management. So I'd love to hear from you.
Yep. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there's a contact form where you can join the conversation. And Carl and I and the other hosts of the show are available via LinkedIn or on our about pages on Ascendo. And as you know, we'd love hearing from you. And it's a great way for you to help us keep the show in line with what you need to know, which we'd like to know. So with that, so Carl, I'm not going to go rock climbing later today.
Maybe cut some logs.
Yeah, maybe just get my chainsaw out. Nice, safe activity instead.
Right.
All right. Thanks, Carl.
Thank you, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.